I'm Brian Karam, and I've spent decades covering politics. Now I'm taking you behind the scenes, one interview at a time.
Join us as each week Brian confronts the issues that matter, posing the questions you wish you could ask. No filter, no agenda, just the truth.
We're not here for sound bites. We're here for substance. Join me, Brian Karam, every week as we cut through the noise and get straight to it. This is Just Ask the Question, where curiosity will lead us to the facts.
Subscribe now on your favorite podcast platform. And remember, when you want answers, all you have to do is just ask the question.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there, I'm Jeff Stein. This is Spy Talk. For those of us who grew up during the Cold War, the world seems to have turned upside down in recent days. It hardly needs enumerating, but let's just say that hearing a president of the United States taking Vladimir Putin's side on much of anything, but particularly his brutal invasion of Ukraine, has been jarring, even otherworldly, to many of us. But I wanted to hear more of what the Ukrainians are thinking, and to that end, my guest today is Glenn Korn, a senior former CIA operations officer with wide experience in war zones, who recently traveled to Ukraine on a kind of inspection trip, traveling around the country and taking the temperature of a wide variety of Ukrainians, from military and civilian officials to ordinary citizens. He's here with me now. Glenn Korn, welcome back to Spy Talk. We're in grim times here. You just came back from Ukraine. You went there a couple of weeks ago. Tell us what you saw, why you went, what you did.
Well, thanks for having me on the show. I was in Ukraine for almost 3 weeks with a former colleague of mine, good friend, and a journalist from Australia who we know. So that was the beginning of our trip. We visited a couple of cities, traveled around, and spoke with a lot of Ukrainians, both in the government, civil society, friends we have, just to see what's going on, let them know that we are continuing our interests, or let's just say the Americans continue to remain very interested in what's going on and want to get the ground truth. And then at the end of our trip, we linked up with General Petraeus, who had a delegation there to attend a conference. And he asked that we join some of the meetings that he did, which was always a pleasure. It was a lot of fun, and brilliant guy. So it's fun to be with him. Mm-hmm. You know, you say it's grim times, and it's definitely like there's a lot of turbulence, but I don't want to be too negative. And, you know, we can get into like what's going on the ground there. And I'm sure since we left and got back, you know, the White House meeting was not a good meeting. But hopefully things are going to right themselves. I can give you my assessment on that when you're ready.
Okay. What White House meeting was not a good meeting?
Oh, the Oval Office meeting with Zelensky. Right.
So you went there before all this happened.
Right. We were there before that. And, you know, I mean, when you say grim times, of course, it's grim times in many ways for the Ukrainians because they're being pounded. Mm-hmm. The Russians continue to, you know, every night we were in every city we were in, there were air raids, either cruise missile strikes or drone strikes. Thank God for the proficiency of the Ukrainian anti-aircraft units. That's run by the Ukrainian Air Force. And for the assistance that they've gotten from the United States and other allies.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they shoot down almost everything the Russians throw at them, but the Russians do get through sometimes, and it's sad to see, and that is grim.
For sure. A little bit, I mean, to some degree, like London under the Blitz in 1940, and especially now they must be feeling pretty alone, although the Europeans seem to be rallying to their side. But I want to get back to what you saw and what you did. Did you feel a sense among the Ukrainians you talked to that they had a shot at throwing back the Russians and maybe regaining territory? What was the attitude or the mood?
Honestly, I would say, Jeff, you know, we were there in September as well for a couple of weeks. And even then, the Ukrainians were saying they want peace. They want this war to stop. I think they realized that the opportunity that they had in 2022 to expel the Russians was lost. It wasn't lost because of them. It was lost because we hesitated in providing them the support they needed to sustain their counteroffensive, which was going very well. Everything since that point has kind of been back and forth for them. But I think most Ukrainians that I spoke with realize that they're not going to be able to take back their territory militarily in the near term. They want peace. There are different opinions on whether or not they want some of the territory that's been occupied. And, you know, just unofficially, some people were saying some areas that the Russians have occupied, they don't want back because the Russians have destroyed it. And it would take a lot to rebuild it. But most Ukrainians say they want their territory back. But I think they're also very realistic that it's going to take a long time, and maybe through diplomacy or economic development is a better way. And, you know, the examples that we heard and, you know, West Germany, East Germany, you know, unification of the Germanies after the Cold War, the Baltic states, which were initially, you know, we never recognized that they were not independent countries. And I give the example a lot of Nagorno-Karabakh and Azerbaijan, a country which for almost 30 years had to accept or didn't never accept it. I shouldn't say that. I correct myself. They had to live with the fact that their territory, in their view, was occupied by a foreign force. And it took them 30 years to get it back, but eventually they got it back.
I'm interested in what you said, that the Ukrainians seem to recognize that some territory they don't want back because it's been so wrecked. Can you drill down on that a little bit?
Well, some again, this is some, not everybody, but some were saying that the Russians have done, you know, they've basically brought in, which is the Russian game plan. They've done this before. They brought in they're colonizing some of these areas, or they're brainwashing the citizens of some of these areas. Of course, there's been a lot of destruction and not a lot of economic development. And, you know, if you look at the history of some of the areas that are being fought over, you know, there was already a large Russian population, and the Russians are just reinforcing that and undermining whatever influence the Ukrainians had, or the Ukrainian state. But again, I want to stress that that's just some of the Ukrainians I spoke with. Others made it very clear they want all their territory back. But they're, you know, very few said we're ready to take it back militarily. And almost everybody we spoke with said we're ready for peace. We're ready for a ceasefire. And of course, the issue is we just need some guarantee, some level of confidence that the Russians are not going to reinvade in 2 years, or not be allowed to reinvade in 2 years to 3 years to 5 years, which is, again, the Russian playbook. And, of course, they're saying that the terms that Putin is proposing right now for a peace deal, they can never accept, because they realize that if Putin gets his way, many of the people that have been fighting for the sovereignty of Ukraine will die with a bullet in the back of their head in the basement of a building, which is right. An ugly thought, but there's a region with a lot of ugly history.
Right. There's some commentary you see here in the West saying that the Russians are equally exhausted by the war, that they can't keep up this level of commitment. Losses are just too much. What do you think of that?
Oh, I agree with that. I think that the Russians are struggling. I think that Putin's trying to give us, you know, here in the West and in Washington, the impression that everything is fine, that he can outlast Ukraine and he can outlast the West. I think that is a Potemkin village. You know, that's a ploy that he's using. I don't think it's true. You know, one of the people we spoke with, the mayor of Kiev, when we spoke with him, who is a world champion boxer, and by the way, a pretty impressive guy, you know, he said it's like a boxing match. Sometimes when you're in like the 12th or the 13th round, you're aching, you're tired, you're exhausted, your head hurts, your fists hurt, you know, your whole body's in total pain, but you have to remind yourself that your opponent is also in the same situation, so you don't give up. And I think it's important to remember that the Russians are also struggling.
Okay, good. Let's. You're a career CIA operations official.
So I want to ask you about this intelligence sharing. How important was it to Ukrainian success on the battlefield and beyond with the missile strikes into Russia? And how important is it that the intelligence sharing, or how damaging will it be that the intelligence sharing has been cut off?
Yeah, Jeff, I don't really want to comment on that because I don't know the details. I have to stress that when I retired, I wasn't working that issue. I was working in another country and other issues. I don't really know. I mean, I'm sure that whatever assistance we've given has been helpful. I'm not sure the details of what the parameters of the stand down are. I do understand that the National Security Advisor said that there's hope that things will go back to normal or things will be worked out. There are some disagreements between Kiev and Washington that they're working through. And I will say this, the Ukrainians themselves are very, very proficient and they're very good. And so I would kind of turn this on maybe around and say, if we lose the collaboration with the Ukrainians, we're losing something very serious because they're really good at what they do.
Mm-hmm.
And that redounds
to us that their intelligence gathering on the Russians and their order of battle is very valuable to us.
Well, you know, this is one thing I said a lot since I've started traveling to Ukraine and coming back and talking about this issue publicly. I think we have to remember that one of the senior Ukrainian officials we met with said something which sticks in my head, and it should be very concerning to all the listeners. He said, when this war is over, and it's going to come to an end probably soon, there will be an agreement. The world is going to be flooded with Russian and Ukrainian mercenaries. You have thousands and thousands of fighters who have been on the front, and they don't know anything but war for the last 3 years. When we think about any of us who've been in, you know, like what we call the war zones, difficult situations, high threat environments for long periods of time, PTSD is a factor which, you know, we've all learned the hard way going back to, probably every war. Mm-hmm. But after Vietnam, you know, the Vietnam War syndrome they talked about, now Iraq, Afghanistan on the American side. I would say what the Ukrainians and the Russians are looking at is that on crack. Okay. I mean, how many millions of troops have been on the front lines in World War I style conditions? And when they come back from the battlefield, what are they going to do? And so one of the things the Ukrainians are, you know, saying is we're going to need help rehabilitating, finding work for these people. Of course, the Russians are going to have the same problem. I don't know if they're thinking about that. It seems that they are not, because I don't know that they really, I mean, I'm not going to speak for the Kremlin, but Russia is going to be faced with, it's already being faced with the wave of violent crime, in economic instability, social instability from all the veterans that are returning. You read like some of the Russian media and some of the stories that are coming out of Russia. And a lot of these people are going to be looking for work. And remember the 90s, you know, organized crime problems around the world, brain drain. And of course, on the Ukrainian side and the Russian side, don't get the Russians, don't underestimate them. They're very creative. On both sides, there are people that have been designing weapon systems that are very, very effective. Some like off-the-shelf tools, you know, you don't need a major corporation to produce them. And they've been killing people with these weapons very effectively. People are going to be out there to hire them, to use them, whether it's transnational crime groups, you know, narcotics, terrorist organizations. And we need partners like the Ukrainians to help us stop all that. Okay? We need our European partners and other, you know, what we call liaison services to help us deal with it. That's how we dealt with the CT problem for years, through partnerships.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say this, many of your listeners probably think I'm crazy, but we also probably going to need the Russians to clamp down this problem in the future.
How do you see that happening?
Well, I mean, so if the problem's coming out of Russia, and in the 90s, there was a dialogue on counterproliferation. There were efforts to try and make
terrorism.
Sure. Loose nukes, terrorism. And so, you know, it's not easy. But if the problem's coming out of Russia, and if Russians realize, and they have to be made to realize, it's not in their best interest to let that problem spread, right? Then we're going to need some assistance making sure that those problems don't become bigger problems around the world. Not just us. We're not just going to need it. The Europeans are going to need it. you know, Middle East is going to need, everyone's going to need it.
Did you get a sense when you were in Kyiv that Ukrainians are aware of or are experiencing already this problem of social breakdown?
Yes.
And crime because of the dislocations of the war and destruction of the war?
Yes. I mean, I think that they're struggling with this. The other thing they're struggling with is a labor shortage, because a lot of the, you know, people are going to the front to fight. So they're having a hard time with some services because a lot of Ukrainians have left the country and a lot of skill has left. They don't really want to come back to the country for obvious reasons. Or, you know, there's all kinds of stresses that are on people. And let's think about this, Jeff. Every night there are air raids going off. And so when an air raid goes off, you're supposed to go to a bunker. Think about the children. Think about the teenagers that are living like that. The stress on the parents. When you're, you know, we were driving down the street one day and I saw two kids walking down, like going to the school with their backpacks. And, you know, think about the parents that have to let their kids walk down the street. What happens if they get hit by a drone?
Yeah.
Right. So this is I'm sure this is wearing on the Ukrainian people. Many of the people we spoke with are very aware of it. They're very concerned about it. They're looking for ways to deal with it. And many said that, you know, Ukraine is going to need a lot of assistance.
In general, how would you assess what you're hearing from Ukrainian officials and military people, political people, intelligence people, and so on, about, first of all, about the factor of support from the U.S. and the Europeans. How big a factor does that play into their psychology?
I think the biggest thing for them is the moral support. You know, the idea that we understand that their territory has been stolen, has been grabbed. You know, the military support obviously has been very important to them. I go back to a discussion we had back in September of 2023, where a very senior Ukrainian military commander told me, he said, you know, in the beginning, in February of 2022, when the Russians came mass across the border, he said his troops were overwhelmed, outgunned, outnumbered, and the morale initially was very low. But when the first javelin did its magic, he said the morale went like this.
Boom.
And every time they'd get a new weapon system from the United States, it gave them an incredible amount of confidence. And so I think, obviously, that like our support is very, very important.
And with the Europeans,
they're looking like long term. They're looking, okay, they're already talking about rebuilding their country. They're already talking about like the economic recovery.
That's pretty optimistic.
Well, I think they know they have no choice. And the other thing that they were saying, and which is ironic, is they all say, you know, we're talking about this rare earth, you know, agreement. Many of the Ukrainians are saying, we want Americans to do something like this. We want Americans coming in to do business. We want them side by side with us. We want to learn.
In fact, that they had been talking about that for a number of years now.
Yeah.
We have to take a break right now. We'll be back in a second. Okay, we're back.
That seems to, all this lays on the assumption that the Ukrainians are going to get a settlement that they can live with. What if they don't? I mean, now events are moving so swiftly. I mean, we just have in the last 48 hours, Europeans really standing up and saying, we are going to defend Ukraine. Now, a lot of that could be just, there's a lot of talk about defending. Actually,
right.
Putting the rubber on the road, you know, with actual weapons and intelligence support. And the general opinion I've heard is that the Europeans can't replicate the intelligence support that we give to the Ukrainians from the Starlink system to advanced satellite communications and targeting and so on. The Europeans just not really up to snuff with it. I mean, there's just no comparison to the kind of assets we bring to the field. So let's say the Europeans don't actually show up in the battlefield, can't supply on their own, can't agree on a stabilization measure like putting European troops into Ukraine. So the Ukrainians have to settle for something else. Can you see from what you saw and the conversations you had in Ukraine, Do you get the sense that they're going to fight on in some form anyway if they're forced to concede a lot, that they would continue? And this goes to your point of what happens to all these fighters. That at least some Ukrainians are going to continue to fight against the Russians no matter what?
Well, yes. I mean, first of all, what Ukrainians are, many of the Ukrainians that we know were saying is, look, like, if we have to go by Putin's terms, the terms that the Russians have proposed, that's basically death for us. Right. And whenever it's better to fight with the shovel on the front line and die that way than to be, you know, executed or thrown in jail for the rest of our lives. Right.
Yep.
And that's a very visceral thing. These are guys that have been on the front fighting and protecting their homes, protecting their villages. They realistically, you know, I think many of the Ukrainians understand the U.S. is not going to put troops in Ukraine. The U.S. is not going to, you know, NATO is probably going to be a long haul, if ever. They've talked about different variations of the Europeans. And when we say Europeans, what does that mean? I mean, there's different powers, different influence, different levels of commitment and support, right? If we talk about the issue of Europe, I have to say this administration, I agree with them. They warned the Europeans for 4 years when they were in the White House before that the Europeans were not paying up their share of for the common defense. They kept doing business. And I remember this very clearly, you know, they kept doing business with the country that they were saying that we need to protect them from and is dangerous. They didn't listen on Nord Stream. They didn't listen on Huawei. Right. And now all of a sudden, like, we're the bad guys because this administration is saying enough is enough.
Yeah, I must say, I'm hearing prominent voices in French and German parliament saying, look what happened. You know, there was a lot of talk, but we didn't come to their aid. This is from Hawks. Right. Say, OK, now we got to do it.
Right.
Because Trump's abandoning Ukraine. So. It's now our time, and we told you had to put some meat behind all this bullshit about supporting Ukraine, and now we got to do it. We got to build up and defend ourselves, by the way, not just Ukraine.
Right. Well, I mean, again, I don't agree with the premise that Trump is abandoning Ukraine. I think he's taking.
Well, let me ask you about that. What is your sense that this is all a ploy?
I think that first, I find it amazing that people have been so upset that he's talking about, like, you know, he wants a peace deal. He wants this fighting to stop. I think the Ukrainians want it to stop. I'm sure a lot of Russians want it to stop, and we should want it to stop. So it's a noble intent. I think the way that the president is approaching it, I don't understand completely, but I keep remembering that, you know, when Ronald Reagan was the president and he decided to engage Gorbachev, all the experts said he was wrong. If you go back and look at the history, they all criticized him. Kissinger.
I wouldn't say all.
a lot of people criticized him. You know, he's just a cowboy. He's an actor. He doesn't really understand. And he was right. And so I think we have to. Everyone's
right. But he didn't give away the store before the negotiations.
Well, we don't know, right? I mean, I think a lot of people are jumping to conclusions. I'm not on the inside. I don't know. I'm not privy to, like, what we're offering or not offering. And so I think, unfortunately, like, this spat with Zelensky didn't help because it gives an impression that we're abandoning Ukraine. I don't really think we're going to abandon Ukraine. I hope we're not. And I don't know what's being told to Putin. I mean, when President Trump came to office on the first day he was in the Oval Office, he said, you know, like, I'm going to, if the Russians don't make peace, I'm going to make them pay a price for it. Right. And I hope that that's also in his plan, that if Moscow refuses to cooperate and refuses to give us, come to the peace table and negotiate sincerely, then they're going to be made to pay a price. And I hope, like, I mean, one of the things is we're stopping aid for the Ukrainians. My own view is we should also tell the Russians, if you keep attacking Ukraine, like launching these missile attacks and these strikes on civilian targets, that is not sincere. Sign that you're ready to make peace. And we can't, like, we're not going to deal with that. We should not make the mistake we made in Syria, where we were negotiating with them and they were continuing to kill Syrian opposition, continuing to launch airstrikes as they had their diplomats sitting in Geneva or wherever, Vienna, wherever the Astana, you know, saying, oh, yeah, we want an agreement. And then you'd find out that they launched three more airstrikes. That is not, in my opinion, we should not allow that to happen.
Well, I don't want to belabor the point, but it seems to me when you're cutting off intelligence sharing and arms deliveries and telling the Russians that they can, you know, you're opening ploys to give the Russians what they want, and Ukraine expressing sympathy with Moscow, more sympathy to Moscow than Ukraine, then there's something out of whack here. If this is some sort of negotiating ploy in which the administration will come around to backing Ukrainian resistance, which everyone recognizes is Europe's resistance and tied to our own national security, then I'm all for it. And I hope it turns out that way, from your lips to Allah's ears, as they say.
Yes. Well, again, like I think this is too early to jump to a conclusion. I don't know. I mean, what do we know that is being offered to Moscow other than, you know, we've started a dialogue with the Russians, which, by the way, the Biden administration did when they came into office. Every administration since Putin has been in power has tried to dialogue with him.
So, Clinton reset.
Right. And after they invaded Georgia.
Yeah. So.
And so.
Mistakes were made.
Well, okay, mistakes were made. But it's also, there's nothing wrong with, like, diplomatic dialogue. It actually can be very useful.
Totally.
So I just hope that with that, because I support the president on what he's trying to do, I just hope that we understand the messaging that has to come with that too, is that, like, we are willing to cut off aid to the Ukrainians if they are not going to be cooperative, but also if the Russians are not going to be cooperative, we are going to, I mean, we can't cut off aid, but what we can do is increase aid to the Ukrainians. What we can't do is increase pressure on the Russian economy.
I don't know how much more cooperative the Ukrainians can be except to carry the fight for us in Europe, but that's my point of view. But what you're saying, if I could sum up accurately, is that your trip to Ukraine gave you great hope that the Ukrainians remain strong despite all their setbacks and problems. They're worried about the future like they should be, and we all should be, and what the fallout from this long war is going to be.
I mean, again, the Ukrainians, despite all the problems they have, and they have problems, they continue to put on a good face and they smile. And, you know, I don't think it's just a dog and pony, because we talk to all kinds of different people in different places. We see, you know, like, for example, we were in Odessa, downtown Odessa, on a Sunday, and the air raid sirens go off, and there are the people are walking their children, like they're still out in the sunshine. And we were with some Ukrainians, and I asked one guy, I said, what should we do? He said, go get a beer. So, I mean, they refuse to be cowered by like this. But deep down, of course, they're feeling the pain. They're suffering, and they want to end to the war. And what I would say is I've seen from the people, the majority of people we speak with, they're very realistic that, you know, they want to come to an agreement. And they're willing to work with the United States for that agreement. You know, we can talk about the way that Zelensky handled this. You know, I think he also kind of bears some of the responsibility for that breakdown in the Oval Office, because he had an opportunity, and I think he misplayed his. I think he misread the audience, and that was not good. And we have a president of one country who has one thing in his mind all the time. We have another president of another country. You know, unfortunately, I don't know that, you know, the president of the United States has to answer the American people, and I don't know that the American people want to continue to fund this war forever. I think they've shown that they don't.
No, I don't think they want to give away Ukraine to the Russians either.
I hope not.
We don't want a president mouthing approval of Russians in the way it's been done so far. But I'm tempted to just leave it at that. But I had to ask you one small bore question. How much of a threat is internal security to is internal security a big problem with Ukrainians? You know, there's still a number of pro-Russian politicians around. There have been some dismissals of senior intelligence and military officials whose loyalty was suspect and so on. Do you have any assessment of that?
Well, this is where it gets very complicated. One, when we were there, they arrested, the SBU arrested one of their senior officers for allegedly working for Russian intelligence, right? I think what's very complicated, Jeff, is that a lot of the people are complaining about what's going on politically. Right. They complain about corruption. They complain about, you know, problems. And it's very hard to weed out what is maybe Russian disinformation seeping into the network, like into the information sphere, and what is legitimate. But you can't immediately say, no, there's no problems, everything is great, honky-dory, because that is not true. And you also can't jump to the conclusion that everything is horrible and, you know, like Zelensky's a dictator. That's not true. But there were plenty of people that said that they are very concerned that, you know, about what's going on politically, and they feel they're being targeted or other people are being targeted because they are in opposition to the current administration.
Right. And all this is complicated by the corruption issue, which right. is endemic right. in Ukraine for decades.
Right. And again, you know, my own view, I've come to this conclusion, maybe I'm crazy, but I think that's why they need American business in there. They need investment in there. I don't think the U.S. government can solve this problem, honestly, but U.S. business can, because if they have Americans side by side with them, you know, they're coming from a system that for years, I mean, going back to the Soviet system, the corruption was a big part of the picture, the way they do business, you know. We heard the complaint of many of the younger Ukrainians that Ukrainians that are in positions of power have the Soviet mentality, right? They're still thinking like from the Soviet times. They mm-hmm. need mentors. They need people. And, you know, as an American, I think we could provide that. And you know, U.S. corporations like we've done in other countries, war-torn countries, when we've helped rebuild them, one of the keys was having U.S. companies in there, executives in there, and then teaching the local population. And this is one thing America does, which I don't know that any other country does this. We occupy a country, or we come into a country, we rebuild the country, and then we turn the country back over to the people of that country. And Germany and Japan.
Yeah. And our democratization and business efforts didn't work out too well in Russia in the end, but that's maybe not our fault. The way they're built.
You know what? Democracy, okay, we can talk about Russia for a long time. First of all, I think our goals were a little bit confused and unrealistic. We didn't take into consideration the local factor, the cultural factor, the historic factor. We just assumed we could just lay this on top, our system on top of Russia, and it would be fine. And, you know, unlike Germany after the war, we didn't have U.S. troops there.
Yeah.
Unlike Japan, we didn't have an occupation army. And so I remember I worked in Russia in the early 90s, mid 90s, and I think our approach was a little bit confused, and we didn't want to listen to the many Russians that were telling us, what you're doing is not working. This is not going to work for us. Like, we need our own local version.
Well, we hope we're going to find some stability provided by some kind of Western military presence in Ukraine to keep the Russians out and to create an environment where the kinds of business opportunities and freedom building opportunities you're talking about can exist and flourish. I mean, that's what we'd all like, right?
Right. When we talk about a Western military presence, you know, I think sometimes we're maybe thinking 20 years ago. I think that the Ukrainians have proven they can defend their country when they're well armed, when they're supported. And of course, one of the things we saw too is that the nature of warfare has changed completely. The FPV, the drone warfare, the semi-autonomous weapon systems have made a huge difference. So maybe there's an alternative without having to put U.S. or French troops on the ground.
Yeah, I would add, let's restore our cyber warfare programs against the Russians for starters. So I mean, I'm more worried than you are, obviously.
But here's the problem, Jeff. When you say let's restore them, I don't know that we've done away with them. You know, I think there's a lot of speculation, but unless, like, I don't know that we've stopped them. I've read a lot of different things, and so I just am very hesitant to come to. I would say that if we stopped all our, you know, cyber efforts against any country that has been known to attack us as much as the Russians do, then that's a mistake. But
yeah.
I'm not.
Well, and as some of the cyber war experts and officials have been saying, it's not something you can shut off anyway. You can dial it up and you can dial it down. But, you know, it goes on. It's in the systems. Right. We're in each other's. The Russians are in our pants. We're in theirs, Chinese, et cetera. So
right.
It's just a difference of degree. But there's a lot of, as you suggest, there's a lot of confusing information and sourcing coming out of both sides right now, and we have to be careful to parse it and say what's confirmable and what's true.
That's right. Unfortunately, my experience when President Trump was in the Oval Office last time was not a very good one with a lot of the media and a lot of people that based on innuendo, anonymous sources, a lot of claims that never were proven to be true. I know in my own experience, some things that were said that were untrue. And so I'm now, like many Americans, very, very skeptical. And I think maybe this is a good opportunity for Americans to learn to think critically again and to question everything very carefully and do a lot of research before jumping to conclusions. We see in the information space, you know, it's very easy to find emotional issues to get people spun up. It happens to me every day. I read something and all of a sudden I can feel my blood pressure going up. But then you got to take a step. Oh, wait a minute. Let me do some research here. And
well, those are words I live by and that we live by at Spy Talk. Let's try to get ground truth.
Right.
And with that, thanks, Glenn, for taking out time on a very busy day for you and a very busy time to come on the show. It's really, really appreciated. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me. It's great to see you again.
And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Many thanks for listening. You can find lots more interesting conversations like this one in our archives available at our home at the MSW Network or on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, mosey on over to our Spy Talk newsletter on Substack, where my colleagues and I offer fresh reporting and analyses from the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll find your way there. This week's Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and expertly edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. That's it. I'm Jeff Stein. See you around.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.
Hi, I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.